Okay, so again, this week is Parshas Tazria. Rather than go through the detailed Parsha as we normally do inside, we're going to study a topic which is a corollary of our Parsha. I will just tell you a beautiful insight from Yisrael Salanter, so you have something from the Parsha. Ask Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, what is the connection between last week's Parsha and this? What is the theme? We know that we often understand, we learn from Smichas HaParshias, when there's a juxtaposition, or there's a connection between two adjacent sections, we learn something from it. Nothing is coincidental, nothing is chance. So I asked Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, what's the connection between the end of Parsha Shmini, the second half, which deals with all the laws of Kashrus, what we studied in depth last week, and saw all the different Mefarshim, and Parshas Tazria, which deals with the laws of Tzaras. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, in his typical fashion, says, you know what the connection is? Torah is telling us something very important. Be as careful with what comes out of your mouth as what you put into it. Parsha Shmini is all about what we put into our mouths. It's the laws of Kashrus. And we are forever learning about, and in many cases adding more stringencies to what we put in our mouth. The technicalities and the minutiae of Kashrus, the biotechnology of food, the new laws that are coming out, emulsifiers and additives and derivatives and ingredients, the complexities of kashrus that are changing every single day. And we have organizations and we have halachic journals and articles and tshuvos, and we have the chumrah of the week when it comes to kashrus. People who are scrupulous in terms of what they eat and where they'll eat and in whose home they'll eat. We are scrupulous when it comes to what we put in our mouths. Says Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, right after Parsha Shmini comes, Parsha Tazria, to tell us, be as careful of what comes out of your mouth, what you say and how you speak, as what you put in your mouth. Because after all, while many, many reasons are given for the cause of Tzara'as, of a spiritual leprosy, Rav Hirsch describes at length that of course it's not a physical leprosy, it's not a physical dermatological ailment, we're talking about a spiritual disease. Evidence from the beginning of the parasha, Tazria says, if you're covered from head to toe in this indication, you're in fact tahor, you're not tameh, you're not contaminated. If it was a dermatological disease, a skin disease, it would make no sense that if you're fully covered by it, then of course you are... Of course, you're diagnosed with, and you are also contagious. So clearly, Rav Hirsch proves from here and a number of other points that this is a spiritual ailment. Many, many reasons are given for the cause of the spiritual ailment. The most popular and famous among them is Lashon Hara, gossip, rechilus. That in fact, mitzora comes from the etymology of motzi ra. The mitzora brings evil into the world. The Slonim Rebbe says that when it comes to other sins that we do, we make momentary lapse of judgment. We have momentary moments of insanity. We shouldn't have thought that, looked at that, eaten that. But whom do we affect? Ourselves. We have a terrible moment, lapse of judgment, and we have an indiscretion, and the result is a negative impact on ourselves. But when we share gossip or rechilus, when we spread something negative, when we marginalize, when we dismiss, when we judge others, we're motzi ra. We haven't just done ra. It's not that we performed something negative ourselves in an indiscretion, but we've brought ra, we've brought evil and wickedness into the world. We've created something that now needs to be reckoned with. Speech creates. We know that. God created the world through speech. Our scholar in residence this past Shabbos, Rabbi Ari Kahn, spoke at Shal Shudas about this idea. That God created the world. We know He didn't need speech. He could have created the world with thought. Could have created the world just by creating. And nevertheless, it goes out of its way. Our rabbis teach us that God created the world with speech. Speech creates. If there's any generation who can appreciate this more than any, it's ours. With speech recognition technology. You talk into your phone. I'll tell you a great story. I should really save this for a drusha, but my wife just told me this story. She was putting one of our daughters to sleep, and they were saying Shema, and my daughter looked up and said, "Who is Hashem married to?" So before Yecheved had a chance to say anything, she says, "I know, he's married to Siri, because you hear Siri, and Siri does what you ask, but you can't see Siri, just like Hashem. And just like Hashem, Siri lives in the cloud." That's what she said. Hashem's married to Siri. Chas v'shalom, chas v'shalom. We have to, of course, we have to correct that and teach that. But anyway, So you take your phone, you press a button, you tell Siri what you want. Speech recognition technology. You get in the car, and you could speak into the car, and it lowers the windows, or it changes the radio station, or it adjusts the climate. Speech recognition. So we know that speech creates. So motzi ra. It's not just, says the Slama Rebbe, like other indiscretions where we've done something negative ourselves, we've brought ra, the Chavetz Chaim's great metaphor to the pillow and the feather. Right? Everybody knows that. The person who came to the Chavetz Chaim, I've spoken Lashon Hara, how can I correct it? The Chavetz Chaim said, bring me a pillow. Brought him a pillow. In those days it was filled with feathers. Chavetz Chaim cut a hole and then slammed the pillow, and the feathers began to spread everywhere. And he said, collect all the feathers. The man said, I can't. They're blowing everywhere. There's no way I can track them down. And he said, that is Lashon Hara. It's motzi ra. The minute you spread it, you put it out in the world, it's in the open, you can't bring it back. Blogs and Facebook and text messages and emails and even just conversation over Shabbos table and coffee, you can't bring it back. It's motzi ra. It created wickedness. You know, you made a mistake and you took the wrong jelly beans on Shabbos and it was borer. You did something wrong yourself. You looked at the wrong thing, you did something wrong. You ate something you shouldn't, you ate without a bracha, you did something wrong. But when you speak gossip, you're motzi ra, says the Rebbe. You're bringing wickedness into the world. It's a whole new level, and that's why it yields this punishment, these parshios. It says Rebbe Yisrael Salanter, as his typical fashion. Be as careful with what comes out of your mouth as what you put into your mouth. Hence the juxtaposition of parshios Tazria, of parshios Shmini and Tazria. This was Rebbe Yisrael Salanter. Rebbe Yisrael Salanter, his whole essence was his character development. Was placing an emphasis on the way we treat others as much as we do, or more than the way we treat God. I'll tell you one of the Rabbi Yisrael Salanter story. A person came to him and said, in anticipation of Pesach, what chumrah, I'm going to the matzah factory. I'm going to make my own matzah. There's a matzah factory opening in Boca, actually. We'll be able to make our own matzah in Chaburos. They're just putting the final touches on. If you want to make your own matzah, said to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the great Rabbi Yisrael, I'm going to the matzah factory. What should I be strict about? What chumrah should I adopt for myself? The 18-minute matzahs and the watching and the water and the kalim and the... What chumrah should I adopt? Said Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, you know what chumrah to adopt? Make sure to check that the women who work at the matzah factory are paid properly and are given enough of a break. Who worked in the matzah factory? Poor widows, women who were desperate and destitute. So Salanter said, you know what chumrah you should adopt? Make sure that the women are paid well. Make sure they're given enough of a break. Right? Anyway, there's countless Rabbi Yisrael Salanter stories. Okay, so that's Parshas Tazria. That's an overview of Parshas Tazria. Why Rabbi Chaim Shmulevitz, I'll tell you one other word. Rabbi Chaim Shmulevitz says, why is the Mitzorah, what's the punishment for the Mitzorah? Isolation, seclusion. Michutz l'machane, badad yeshev. They have to live outside the camp. By the way, for how many days? A week in order to confirm the diagnosis, a week outside the camp. Yeshiva Shalom, the Slam Rebbe also has a long essay, why a week? We find a week, everything. The beginning of the parsha, a week with Tumah, with a woman, a week. He says, every time you see the notion of a week, know what the Torah is saying is, what has to happen if you mandate a week? What does the person have to experience?
Shabbos.
When a baby can't have a bris until after a week, what must the baby experience before their bris? A Shabbos. When someone is sent Michutz L'machane, what must they experience? A Shabbos. Shabbos rejuvenates and regenerates and renews. And that's the whole essence of Shabbos. He has a long essay about that. But the Mitzorah is at Michutz L'machane. Why says Rechaim Shmulevitz? Because what was the result? What did the Mitzorah cause others? If you're Motzi Ra, if you speak gossip ill of someone else, you make them feel alone. When you find out, when an individual finds out that they were spoken about negatively, they feel very alone. It's a very lonely feeling. Nobody came to my defense. Nobody stopped it. Everyone allowed it. Everyone accepted it. Everyone listened to it. Nobody questioned it or challenged it. It makes you feel terribly isolated and alone. So therefore, the speaker of the Lashon Hara, Mida Keneged Mida, in order to understand the harm that they caused, must live Michutz L'machane Badad Yeshev. They must be alone in order to understand the aloneness, the isolation they made someone else feel. Okay, there's a lot more to talk about Tazria, but we're going to talk about another subject. Abortion. This year is the 41st anniversary of Roe versus Wade. We're now 4 decades past the landmark Supreme Court decision that revolutionized the law on abortion in our blessed country. Source number 1, page 1. If you're listening online, you'll see the source sheets there. Now we got to do this really quickly. Roe versus Wade, Wikipedia, the great authoritative work. has a summary of this decision. In deciding Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court ruled a Texas statute forbidding abortion except when necessary to save the life of the mother was unconstitutional. Court did not recognize right to abortion in all cases. What the court basically had to decide was the following. Is the notion of abortion, what is the status of a fetus, what is the status of an embryo in utero? Do we view the fetus as a identity unto itself with its own rights and its own entitlements? Or do we view the fetus as an organ of the mother? Is the fetus essentially a liver, a kidney, a bladder? Is the kidney just another organ of the mother? In which case the mother maintains and retains a right to privacy and a right to autonomy? Or does this fetus have an independent status and therefore independent rights? And what the court in Texas ruled and was later expanded upon was that the right to privacy existed for the mother and included the right to have an abortion. And why did it reach this conclusion? Instead, it chose to point out historically under English and American common law and statutes, quote, the unborn have never been recognized as persons in the whole sense. And thus the fetuses are not legally entitled to the protection afforded by the right to life, specifically enumerated in the 14th Amendment. So though we have a constitutional right to life, that right to life exists for whom? The living, a person. Roe Wade determined that the unborn are not living in the whole sense, and therefore are not covered by the right to life, and essentially, therefore, the unborn are viewed as an extension of the mother, an organ, a limb of the mother. The mother has a right to privacy, and a right to choose, and a right to abort. Now, interestingly, it's just a footnote. It's not meaningful, but it's interesting. Jane Roe of the landmark Roe v. Wade, whose real name is Norma McCorvey, is now an anti-abortion advocate. McCorvey writes, she never had the abortion, became the pawn of two young and ambitious lawyers who were looking for a plaintiff they could use. Now, I'm sure that this case would have nevertheless come before the Supreme Court. Someone else would have brought it. Nothing would have changed historically. But I think it is a fascinating footnote that the Roe of Roe v. Wade is now a staunch anti-abortion advocate. This decision has had massive consequences. Just how many? In the last 40 years, in the last four decades. 40 years is not a lot. In the last 40 years since Roe v. Wade, how many abortions? There were 56 million reported abortions in America alone. Now, to give you perspective on 56 million, you're talking 7 or 8 times the state of Israel. 7 or 8 times the state of Israel never came to live, never came to exist, because they were aborted instead. In the 40 years, 56 million reported abortions in America. Roe v. Wade indeed was a landmark decision. 56 million. The mother has a right to choose was the decision. And we'll get into it right now. Halachically, what is the Jewish view? It's interesting that we view this as a mother's right to choose. We often think about it from the perspective of it's the mother's body, it's a woman's right, it's a woman's right to choose. Just as an editorial aside, this is not halachic or authoritative, but I submit for your consideration. It's a mother's right to choose, it's her body. What if a man and woman have a pregnancy that was not planned, an unplanned pregnancy? And so he turns to her and says, let's have an abortion. I'm not interested. This was a casual relationship. Nobody planned this. And she says, no, I insist on having this baby. So who has to pay for that baby? So why does he not have a right in deciding? Right, this emphasis on the mother's right to choose, the mother's right to privacy. It's all about the mother's body. So if that were right, then the law should be adjusted. The father should have a right to say, well, if it's your right to choose, then it's your right to pay for it. But yet we have this kind of double standard, that it's the mother's right, the mother's privacy, the mother's body, but the father has to finance, the father has to pay for it. That's just as an editorial side, not a halachic statement. Yes? Let's say you can do a paternity test, even in utero. If not, afterwards, can you come back to the court and say, I don't want to pay, I wasn't interested? My point is that it's naive to suggest that only the mother, the woman, has a relationship and it's her choice exclusively. Because that's not the standard that we hold it to. But that's an aside. So 56 million. We're going to get to that right now. So 56 million reported abortions in America. When I heard that statistic and I read that statistic, I couldn't help, my first thought was, what if one of those unborn who never saw the light of day had the cure to cancer? Could you imagine how that could have changed the world? But then my next thought was, what if those unborn was the next Hitler and was going to propagate a terrible genocide or atrocity or evil in this world? We'll never know. We can't look back and try to guess who was unborn and what they would have brought to the world. But I'll just share with you one fascinating insight from the great book Freakonomics. Two economists, Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubner, two great economists, wrote a book applying the principles of economics to contemporary real-world situations. It's a great book. They put out a sequel called Super Freakonomics. They have a blog where they have similar ideas they share regularly. It's really worthwhile. In their book, they say the following. In the first year, Roe versus Wade, 750,000 women had abortions in the United States, one abortion for every 4 live births. By 1980, the number of abortions reached 1.6 million, one for every 2.2 live births. In the country of 225 million people, 1.6 million abortions a year, one for every 140 Americans, may not seem dramatic. In the first year after, when abortion was reinstated in Romania, there was an abortion for every 22 Romanians. But still, 1.6 million American women a year who got pregnant were suddenly not having those babies. Now, before Roe Wade, it was predominantly the daughters of middle or upper class families who could arrange and afford a safe, illegal abortion. Instead of an illegal procedure that might cost $500, after Roe Wade, when it became legal and clinics were opened, any woman could easily attain an abortion, often for less than $100. What sort of woman was most likely to take advantage of Roe Wade? Very often, she was unmarried, or in her teens, or poor, and sometimes all three. What kind of future might her child have had? One study has shown that the typical child who went unborn in the earliest years of legalized abortions would have been 50% more likely than average to live in poverty, would have also been 60% more likely to grow up with just one parent. These two factors, childhood poverty, a single-parent household, are among the strongest predictors that a child will have a criminal future. Growing up in a single-parent home roughly doubles a child's propensity to commit crime. So does having a teenage mother. Another study has shown that low maternal education is the single most powerful factor leading to criminality. In other words, say the authors of Freakonomics, the very factors that drove millions of American women to have an abortion also seem to predict that their children, had they been born, would have led unhappy and possibly criminal lives. To be sure, legalized abortion in the United States had myriad consequences. Infanticide fell dramatically, so did shotgun marriages, as well as the number of babies put up for abortion. Conception rose by nearly 30%. Adoption. Conception rose by nearly 30%, but births actually fell by 6%, indicating that many women used abortion as a method of birth control, a crude and drastic sort of insurance policy. Perhaps the most dramatic effect of legalized abortion, however, and here is their controversial thesis, and one that would take years to reveal itself, was its impact on crime. You see, in the early 1990s, just as the first cohort of children born after Roe Wade was hitting its late teen years, the years during which young men enter the criminal prime, the rate of crime began to fall. What this cohort was missing, of course, were the children who stood the greatest chance of becoming criminals. And the crime rate continued to fall as an entire generation came of age, minus the children whose mothers had not wanted to bring a child into the world. Legalized abortion led to less unwantedness. Unwantedness leads to higher crime. Legalized abortion, therefore, led to less crime. Their thesis, which was very, very controversial, was, said in the 90s, you remember, that then-mayor Rudy Giuliani was credited with fighting crime. He took a hard stand in Manhattan, in New York City, and crime rates fell dramatically. Rudy Giuliani was hailed, thank you, as a hero, was celebrated as being tremendous. Claim the authors of Freakonomics, it wasn't Rudy Giuliani. The crime rate fell because the would-be criminals were never born. Because if you look, Rudy Giuliani's drop in crime came exactly 15, 16, 17 years after Roe versus Wade, when there was an entire cohort of would-be criminals who were never born because they were aborted instead. A very controversial position. So, just as a matter of information, abortion is actually down. It's been going down. It was at an all-time low since Roe Wade last year. This could be for a number of factors. Could be because of advances in birth control, could be because of the morning after pill, could be for a whole host of reasons, but abortion was at an all-time low since Roe versus Wade this past year, but still it is a very, very drastic number. So what is the Jewish view of abortion? That's what I want to spend our time on, and you'll see that it connects loosely to our parsha. But It's interesting. If you look in our world today, there are two very polarized positions on abortion. When you hear this very emotionally charged debate, a debate that usually comes up around election time, when we want to know what our officials believe, it's one of the, it's for some people, it's what they, a position that they vote on. So you hear two different things. There's pro-life and there's pro-choice. Pro-life says abortions are prohibited in all circumstances. We feel fetuses are living beings. They're entitled to rights. And therefore, pro-life, it's murder to abort a fetus. Everything needs to be done to reverse the law and to maintain the rights of these unborn. And pro-life, to maintain their right to life. On the other position you have a very often described, at least in my opinion, as a very casual relationship with these fetuses. It's the mother's right to choose. If she wants to have her appendix removed, if she wants to have Botox, if she wants to have an abortion, it's a mother's right to choose. This is an extension of her body, and a very flippant and casual way in which we talk about abortion, even as a form of birth control, an irresponsible form of birth control. So which one does Judaism have more in common with? If we have to choose an elected official, if this is our position issue we're going to vote on, which one does Judaism have more in common with? The pro-lifer who says, life, the extend the life of the fetus under all circumstances, abortion is murder, it must be stopped? Or the pro-choice, the person, not all, don't mean to overgeneralize, but those who have a very casual, flippant connection and say, it's a mother's body, it's a right for her to choose. She wants to have her wisdom teeth extracted. She wants to have the fetus extracted. It's her choice. So what I want to share with you in our limited time today is that Judaism has, what I think is missing in the public debate and conversation, Judaism has a very nuanced position. It doesn't fit into either of these molds. And frankly, it doesn't fit into most politicians' points of view. We have a very, very nuanced position on this issue, and we have to be very careful who we support politically if we're basing our support on this issue. Source number four, where you see this conversation begins, is a Mishnah in Ahalos. The Mishnah in Ahalos sets down the following fact. Ha'isha shi makasha leled, a woman who is struggling in childbirth. Mechatchin es avlad b'me'eha. The presence of this fetus, fully developed fetus, she's in childbirth, is threatening the life of the mother. So you have a conflict between the well-being of the mother and the well-being of the child. Whose life takes precedence, says the Mishnah clearly, unequivocally, explicitly, the life of the mother. And I would add, graphically, it says it. You cut up the fetus in the womb, and you remove it limb by limb, because the life of the mother takes precedence over the life of the fetus, of the unborn. If the head or most of the body exit, now it's considered to be born. It's not unborn. It's alive. Now there's no difference between the mother and the child. Now there's no conflict in their lives. Now they have equal status, and you're not allowed to kill the child in order to save the mother. So the Mishnah is clear. This is codified in Halacha. By the way, as an aside, this is not what Catholicism believes. Catholicism believes the unborn is as alive as the mother. They have equal rights, and if the mother's life is failing, if the mother's health is failing because of the presence of the fetus, you do nothing. Let the mother die, but you cannot take the life of the fetus in order to save the life of a mother. For many years, Jews were cautioned not to give birth in Catholic hospitals, because if, God forbid, this situation arose, it would not go the way that halacha determines. So this is the Jewish point of view. What do you see from here? Look what Rashi says, source 5. Rashi in Sanhedrin says, you know what you see from here? What you see from here is, we know in general, we saw this in the Daf Yomi recently, that we have a principle. When there's a conflict between two lives, someone puts a gun to my head and says, kill so-and-so or you must die. What is the halacha? It's one of the three cardinal sins. I have to give my life up rather than murder someone else. Now, when it comes to the other cardinal sins, Gilui Arayos and Shvich and Avodah Zarah, the Gemara quotes verses. The Gemara quotes explicit psukim, which teach me that I have to give up my life rather than violate. But when it comes to murder, the Gemara does not quote a verse that teaches me that I have to give up my life rather than murder. Instead, the Gemara quotes a svara. The Gemara quotes a logical conclusion. And what's the logical conclusion the Gemara says? My chaz is... why do you think that your blood is redder, your blood is thicker than the next person? Who says your life is more valuable than the next person? By the way, just as an aside, when I learned this sugya, I have a big question on it. What do you mean? I have the opposite svara. The svara says, v'chai b'hem, chayecha kodman, your life comes first, you have to live. So maybe you're right. My blood is not any redder, but you know what? If there's a conflict between your life and my life, the Torah adjures me that I have to do everything to preserve my life. So the svara says, yeah, kill that person, because chayecha kochai v'chai b'hem. So it's ironic to me that the one that's the most complicated, there's no verse, it's a svara. Okay, that's an aside. That's my question. Also, yeah, if you have a good answer, mitzvah, feel free to share it with me.
Chai mitzvah and the humble one. I mean, even the child is, you know,
oh, so but what do you see from the svara? The Gemara takes for granted. It says it's a logical conclusion that you cannot kill somebody in order to preserve your life. Who says that life is more valuable? But what is the premise of that equation? The premise of the equation is that our lives are equal value. Two living beings, by the way, halachically even, two living beings, one just celebrated their 100th birthday and the other turned 18, are of equal value. You have all these questions halachically of triage. Two ambulances pull into the emergency room at the exact same moment. You have one respirator available, one life support system available. 18-year-old had a motorcycle accident, put him on the respirator, he could save his life, he can live another 80 years. The 100-year-old comes in, put him on the respirator, they may never awaken, let alone what kind of life, quality of life they will have. What does halacha say? Who gets the respirator, the life support? What if the 100-year-old ambulance pulled in 60 seconds before the 18-year-old's ambulance? These triage questions, complicated halachic questions, very, very difficult ones. But you see, the premise of the logical conclusion of the Svara of the Gemara is, lives are of equal value, we don't judge, we don't assign labels. So says Rashi, if the Mishnah and Allah goes out of its way to say that if a fetus challenges the life of the mother, you chop up the fetus. Sorry to be graphic, but that's the language of the Mishnah. You chop up the fetus, you remove the fetus, you preserve the life of the mother. Says Rashi, that can only be because the unborn is not called living. If the unborn were called living, their lives would be equal, you wouldn't be allowed to do it. Says the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Here's something fascinating. Just hold the questions because I see we're going to run out of time. Where does the Torah say abortion is prohibited? This is really the essence of our question today. Where in the Torah, I want to know, where does it say that abortion is prohibited? You ask any Jew, what's the Jewish position on abortion? They'll say, Aser, it's prohibited. Great, where's the verse? What parasha? It doesn't appear in the Torah. Not only does it not appear in the Torah, it doesn't appear explicitly in the Talmud that a Jew is prohibited to perform an voluntary or elective abortion. Says the Gemara Sanhedrin, Nun Zayin Amid Beis, Mishum Bishmol Amru Af Ala Ubarin, a Noachite, a Ben Noach, a non-Jew, is liable for killing a fetus. My time at Rabbi Shmuel, where did Rabbi Shmuel learn this, that a non-Jew is prohibited to abort? Tichsiv, the pasuk says in Parshas Noach, Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam yadamo yishafeich. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. Eza adam shehu ba'adam. It's a very, very peculiar verse. You see all of the commentaries debate over there, trying to understand it. Right? It doesn't flow well, the pasuk. Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam damo yishafeich. A very difficult verse. So says Rabbi Shmuel, who is an Adam Ba'adam? What is a circumstance where there's a person within another person and you're not allowed to take the person within the other person? This is the prohibition of abortion. And to whom is it given? A Ben Noach. This pasuk in Parshas Noach, Shavich Dam Adam Ba'adam, Damo Yishafech, is given to Bnei Noach. This is a Noachide law. So not only is it nowhere in the Torah, even in the Gemara, this prohibition of abortion is given to non-Jews. How do we know we're liable as well? Because we have a principle. Anything that a non-Jew is warned in, certainly a Jew is not allowed to do. We are given more mitzvos. We are given a stricter lifestyle. We're held to an even higher standard. So there's nothing that the non-Jew is forbidden and that the Jew is permitted in. So therefore, we just apply that rule to know that we too are forbidden to perform abortion. But I find it amazing that such a enormous issue as abortion, not only is not a pasuk in the Torah, it's not an explicit passage in the Gemara either. We're simply applying the precedent from Bnei Noach, from non-Jews. By the way, for this reason, the non-Jew who performs an abortion, it's a capital crime. the punishment is the death penalty in the days that there was a Beis Din and the death penalty. Because the Jew, we're just extending the prohibition from the non-Jew, but it's not given explicitly to the Jew, there's no death penalty. It's not considered a capital crime. And this has halachic consequences. Because in times where abortion is permitted, you might think that our poskim would say, find a non-Jewish doctor to do the abortion. It's the opposite. Our poskim say, find a Jewish doctor. Because the non-Jewish doctor has greater consequences, so another sniff, another variable that we employ to permit abortion in certain circumstances is specifically to pursue a Jewish doctor, not a non-Jewish doctor. Fine. Is this prohibition of abortion biblical or rabbinic? We said it doesn't appear in the Torah. The Talmudic passage is talking about in a case of a non-Jew. True, it's a pasuk in Parshas Noach, but is this biblical or is this rabbinic? So you may be surprised to learn that is a subject of debate. Source 7. Source 7 is the Nishmas Avraham. The Nishmas Avraham, which I'm going to draw from extensively this morning. The Nishmas Avraham, Rabbi Dr. Avraham, Avraham, that's his name, who is a great halachic authority and physician in Israel today, in his incredible work, Nishmas Avraham. There are two encyclopedias of medical ethics, which are unbelievably important today. One is called Encyclopedia Rifuis, that's by Rabbi Dr. Steinberg. He's been a guest on our shul a number of times. It's a phenomenal work. It basically covers all medical ethical issues by the order of the alphabet. And the other work is Nishmas Avraham, Rabbi Dr. Avraham Avraham. His son was a classmate of mine in Karen Biavna. So the Nishmas Avraham is organized according to the order of Shulchan Aruch. Medical ethics according to the order of Shulchan Aruch. And it's been translated, the Nishmas Avraham, into English by Art Scroll. So I draw extensively from the Nishmas Avraham because he summarizes these issues very well. The Achiezer, Reb Chaim Ozer Grzinski, writes that, you know, the Achiezer, Reb Chaim Ozer, was arguably the greatest halachic authority in Lithuania and Eastern Europe in the early 20th century. Reb Chaim Ozer Grzinski. Brett Stevens, the great journalist at the Wall Street Journal, former editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post, when he spoke here, he was here for Shabbos a few weeks ago. So after he spoke, after Musaf, because of course we'd never talked during davening, he said, you know, Rabbi, I recently learned that my grandfather's brother was a great rabbi in Lithuania. Maybe you heard of him. I said, who was your grandfather's brother? He said, a Rabbi Grzinski? I said, Rav Chaim Ozer? He said, yeah, that's it. I said, now you know where your brains, now you know where your smarts come from. The great Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski, the Achiezer. The Achiezer says, although the accepted ruling is that the Torah forbids an abortion, the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim, one of the Rishonim, believes the prohibition is rabbinic. The Maharash Engel believes this is also the Rambam's opinion. Rav Chaim Palagi, the Beis Yehuda, the Maharash Engel himself, all rule the prohibition is rabbinic. So you may be shocked to learn that there are a group of Rishonim and Achronim who believe that abortion, what we take for granted, what many Jews say, it's murder, it's wrong, pro-life, that there is a group who believe that abortion is a rabbinic prohibition. Is a rabbinic prohibition. That means that, just to put it in context, if you have that bowl of jelly beans that's mixed colors, and you select the jelly beans in the wrong way, violating the biblical prohibition of borer, you have violated a stricter prohibition than an abortion, in their opinion. Just to put it in context, biblical versus rabbinic. They believe it's rabbinic. In summation, however, a little bit later, the Nishmas Avraham concludes, the majority, the overwhelming majority of Rishonim and Achronim, later authorities, rule aborting a fetus is prohibited by the Torah if there's no danger or possible danger to the mother's life as a result of the pregnancy or labor. The Chikrei Lev writes that the deciding ruling is like that of Tosfos, that aborting a fetus is prohibited by Torah law. It's also the Rambam's opinion, according to the Torah's Chesed. This is the ruling of the Maram Shik, Tzofnos Paneach, Achiezer, Or Sameach, Beis Yitzchik, Stechemed, Yabia Omer, Igros Moshe, Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Revel Yashiv, and many, many others. So we follow the opinion, to put it in context, it's not only no different, it's stricter than the jelly beans, it is a biblical prohibition. But we're left, of course, with the great question. If it's a biblical prohibition, what's the biblical prohibition? It doesn't say anywhere in the Torah. Even the Gemara says, only working off this pasuk in Parshas Noach, dealing with Bnei Noach, non-Jews, what's the biblical prohibition of abortion? What is one violating? What is the prohibition? The Rambam writes in source number 8, Hilchos Rotzeach. Says the Rambam, Afzu mitzvah lo sase shelo achus al nefesh harodef. The Rambam is writing Hilchos Rotzeach in the following law. A is pursuing B. A is trying to kill B. B is innocent. A is a pursuer. C comes along and sees A pursuing B. And what does C do? Kill A. Is C liable for killing A? C is celebrated for killing A. Why? What is A called in halacha? A? A rodef. A rodef is a pursuer trying to kill somebody else. So if you intervene, if you intercede to save the innocent and take out the pursuer, not only are you exempt, but that is the correct thing to do. So that's what the Torah says. Zu mitzvah lo sasei shelachus al nefesh harodef. You're not supposed to take pity on a rodef. You don't say, I can't pull the trigger, I feel bad. Feel bad for the near duff. Show sympathy for the pursued, not the pursuer. Lefichach, in this context, says the Rambam, Horu chachamim sha'uv reshimak sheleled, muter lachto cha'ober me'er, bein besam, bein biyab, neshu, kerodef achareha lehorga. V'mishahot zirosho einogim bo she'ein doche nefesh b'nei nefesh, v'zeo tivu shel olam. Says the Rambam, that the reason, this Mishnah in Olos, the reason if a fetus challenges the well-being of the mother, you kill the fetus is because of one reason and one reason only. What status does the fetus have? The fetus is a rodef. The fetus is a pursuer. It's going to kill the mother. The mother's the nirdaf, the pursued. You as C, the third party, need to not show sympathy to the pursuer, take out the pursuer in order to save the pursued. But says the Rambam, if the baby's head is out, rosho, or rubo, or most of the body, then you're not allowed to touch the baby. What happened? Now the baby is a full purpose. Ein doche nefesh nei nefesh, v'zeo tivo shel olam. Zeo tivo shel olam. Says Rav Moshe Feinstein, based on this Rambam, says Rav Moshe, what do you see from here? The fact that the Rambam has to use the principle of rodef, what do you see from here? He teaches that in fact a fetus is a living person. Because what is the only justification, what is the only defense that we ever have for killing a living person? If they're a rodef. Without there being a rodef, you wouldn't be allowed to kill. So what do you see from the fact that the Rambam needs to invoke rodef in order to justify taking the life of the fetus? How does the Rambam treat the fetus as a fully living being? Which means that taking the life of the fetus when it's not a pursuer is tantamount to murder. So Rav Moshe Feinstein Zatzal's position, source number 9 in Egros Moshe, it's in a number of places, but here's a tshuva, Choshe Mishmar Chelik Beis, Be'inyan HaFalas Uber Levar She'osar Apeshvil Tzar Ha'eim, even when the mother is in pain, he says that abortion, not the mother is threatened, but the mother is just in pain. Abortion is prohibited. And what does he base it on? The Rambam. The fact that the Rambam invokes rodef teaches Rav Moshe that without rodef, taking the life of the fetus is tantamount to murder. And he writes very strongly about this, because he's going to reference the Tzitz Eliezer. Eliezer Waldenberg has a very lenient ruling, and Rav Moshe writes, "Lachein nishtamamti berosi tshuva mechacham echa beretz Yisrael anichtov lemenahal beis acholim Shari Tzedek." Who was the posek of Shari Tzedek? The Tzitz Eliezer of Waldenberg Zatzal. And Rav Moshe says, "I'm shocked to read a tshuva who's lenient in this regard." And Rav Moshe says, "You cannot rule like him." Look at the end of his tshuva. Baru pashet kidek disavti alocha abura apira basena rishonam amfarshim. Haposkim mamish ha'asar bedin ritzicha mamish kol uber ben kasher ben mamzer ben stam ubrim ben hayadum l'choy tesaks kulam asurim medina mamish. Abortion is prohibited as murder, says Rav Moshe. If the fetus is healthy or the fetus has tesaks, if the fetus is regular or the fetus is a mamzer, I don't care, says Rav Moshe, it is murder. Vein litos v'lismach ha'tshuva chacham zeh. Do not make the mistake of following or relying on the tshuva of the rabbi of Shari Tzedek. He's talking about the Tzitz Eliezer. V'shari le'mari b'zeh, v'chavar ha'teira, v'din ha'emes. He said, I had to set aside the covet of this great rabbi because I need to teach the correct thing, which is it would be murder. It would be murder to perform an abortion on a baby just because they have tay-sachs, or the mother is a victim of rape, or the child would be a mamzer, or all these other circumstances, says Rav Moshe, it is murder through and through, based on the Rambam.
Why is it only chayiv alav if it's murder? Oh. When the child is not...
That's a good question. Why is it only alav? Why is there no capital punishment? It's a good question. It's a good question, but for Rav Moshe, it's murder. Source number 10. The Ramban throws a wrinkle. The Ramban is dealing with another Gemara. The Gemara says elsewhere, yes, if the child threatens the life of the mother, we abort the child. But what about if the mother on Shabbos, her health is not compromised, but her pregnancy is? The mother on Shabbos, her pregnancy is compromised. Can she violate Shabbos in order to save the life of the fetus? What's the halacha? Absolutely. Gemara says clearly, you violate Shabbos to save the life of the fetus, the mother will live either way. Can you violate Shabbos to save the life of the fetus? Absolutely. So you're left with the following question. What? Why? If we said that if the fetus threatens the life of the mother, you can abort the fetus, which we concluded means that the fetus is not considered to be living. Well, if the fetus is not considered to be living, then why can you violate Shabbos to save the fetus? You can only violate Shabbos to save a life. If the fetus is not living, why is it permissible to violate Shabbos? This is the question the Ramban deals with. And the Ramban in sources 10 and 11, in Torah Sa'adam, in his commentary on Nida, introduces us to a new concept and says there's an in-between. Until now we thought the unborn is either considered to be a life or not a life. Says the Ramban, there's a third possibility. The fetus is considered to be a potential life. And a potential life also has a status in halacha. When it comes to the conflict between a potential life and a life, who trumps whom? The life. So you save the mother. But can you violate Shabbos even to save a potential life? Absolutely. And the Ramban invokes another Gemara that we're machal Shabbos achas. We violate Shabbos, kedish yishmeru Shabbos harbe, so someone can save, observe many Shabboses. So apply that principle to the unborn. If you violate Shabbos to save the unborn can spend a lifetime of observing Shabbos. So therefore, it's different threshold, different definitions of life. In conflict with the mother, the unborn is called not alive. You save the mother. But in terms of conflict with Shabbos, the unborn is considered a potential life. You violate Shabbos to save the unborn. It's considered. At what point are you considered a potential life? Let's say the IVF doctor in their laboratory, their freezer system, the electricity breaks down, the backup generator breaks down, the freezer breaks down, and all the frozen embryos are going to thaw and they're going to rot. Can the doctor violate Shabbos to save them?
No.
Can you violate Shabbos to violate Shabbos? So this halacha will likely change in our lifetime, or our children's lifetime. But the poskim, Rav Vosner and others say, right now the answer is no. From when are you called a potential life? Only from when, if you leave all well enough alone, it would result in a life. Meaning, a fetus within the womb. Where if you do nothing, in 5 months, 6 months, 9 months, they'll please God be a healthy baby. But an embryo in a freezer, if you leave well enough alone, nothing will happen. So it's not yet called a potential life. Now why do I say it'll change in our lifetime? Because science is advancing at such a rapid rate that in our lifetime, the next lifetime, it's possible they will create an artificial womb. So that the husband will donate sperm and the woman her eggs. Maybe this couple's never even met. Maybe they live on separate continents. And in a laboratory, they'll mix the ingredients, create conception, take this zygote, this blastocyst, this pre-embryo, put it in an artificial womb, and through gestation, 9 months, and give birth to a baby. Maybe in our lifetime, maybe in the next. At that point, a potential life will be determined into potential life much sooner, right? And a different way. But for right now, the post can still say that in the freezer, it's not yet called a potential life. So for the Ramban, though, introduces us to a new principle. And based on this Ramban, the Shevet Alevi, Rav Vosner, a great posek in Bnei Brak, whose great niece lives in our community, Rav Vosner is Jeannie Rab's great uncle, Jeannie's grandmother's brother. So Rav Vosner, a great posek in Bnei Brak, says, based on the Ramban, that Rav Moshe is not necessarily right. It's not murder, because there's no such thing as murder of a potential life. Murder applies to the living. The fact that when you save The fact that Rav Moshe derives this from this notion of the rodef, because even a potential life, in order to take it out, but it doesn't make it murder, because of the Ramban, says Rav Osner, that potential life is not called murder. So if it's not murder, if Rav Moshe is wrong, then what is the prohibition of abortion? What is the biblical prohibition? Why is it wrong? So there are a number of other suggestions which are offered of why it may be. The Chavizyar of Yochayim Bachrach, great posik in the 17th century, Germany. Chavizyar says, you know what it is? It is Hotza Zera Levatala, Hashchasa Zera. Hashchasa Zera. If one is forbidden from, not only are you not allowed to waste seed in terms of the extraction of seed for waste, there's also a prohibition of destroying seed even once it is extracted. So if that's true for seed, all the more so for an embryo, for a fetus. So he says the prohibition of abortion is the destruction of seed, hashchasas zera. Rav Shlomo Zalman Arbach Zatzal, source 14, is quoted in the Nishmas Avram, that we know that there's a halacha. A fetus in utero is considered to be able to own property. Zachen la'adam shelo b'fanav. If you wanted to set up, you know, I learned in wills and estates, you can create a trust fund for an unborn child. Did you know that? Mm-hmm.
No.
A young person who's not even married could set up trusts for their grandchildren. They have no children, but they could set up trusts for their grandchildren. In the law, in American law, wills and estates. Well, in halacha, yeah, I don't know if it's true, davar shelo b'la'olam, not even pregnant, but if a woman is pregnant, you could set up a halachic fund for the fetus, and they would have the halachic status of owning money. Such that if you robbed them, you were stealing. You were violating the prohibition of stealing. So says Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, if that's true for assets, for money that the fetus owns, then certainly it's true for the fetus itself. Just as it's forbidden to rob a fetus of money belonging to it, so too it's forbidden to rob it of life itself. That's the prohibition of murder. There are other suggestions which are given as well. The Maharit says, it can be derived from tort law. You're not allowed to harm or wound. What greater harm or wound is there? Some say it's chavala. It's a prohibition of creating a blemish or a wound. There are all kinds of other suggested reasons of the prohibition of abortion. Ritzicha, chavala, hashchasa zera, and so on. Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, who Rav Moshe was so vehemently against, he rules very leniently when it comes to abortion. He understands that abortion is permitted in many, many circumstances. You can look there in his tshuva, he spells it out. From when is abortion prohibited? When does it begin? Whatever the prohibition is, murder or wasting seed or chavala, causing a wound, or stealing, you're stealing from a fetus, you're stealing its life, whatever these many suggestions, when does it begin? So we have a principle that before 40 days of gestation, of pregnancy, it's not considered a pregnant. It's considered to be embryonic fluid. The woman is bloated. She's not pregnant. Halachically, I don't mean to minimize the feeling of pregnancy. You know, statistically, one third of pregnancies end in miscarriage. One third. Many women don't even know they had a miscarriage. They think they had a heavy flow. They don't even appreciate that they had a miscarriage. But one third of pregnancies end early on in miscarriage. Before 40 days, the Gemara in Yevamos, Samach Tes, calls it Ad Arboyim Maya Ba'almahu. Till 40 days, it's merely water. It's not considered a child, it's embryonic fluid. And there's many halacha consequences. This milestone of 40 days is very significant. First of all, when it comes to Hamapelas Liyom Arboyim Eino Choshesh Levlad, if a woman has a miscarriage before 40 days, she is not considered to having been pregnant. So in other words, if a woman has a miscarriage before 40 days and then has a first child, that first child, if it's a boy, will be the Bechor. If she has a miscarriage after 40 days, that first child is not considered the first of her womb, is not considered to be the Bechor. Yes? Pigeon Aben. Bris. Pigeon Aben, there would be no Pigeon Aben. If she was pregnant for more than 40 days and miscarried, there would be no Pigeon Aben. If it was less than 40 days, there would be. Another example, this relates to our parsha, is does she sit the Yimei Tumah V'Tahara? Does she have the status of a Yoledes? is she, what our parsha begins with, does she have the status of a woman who gave birth with the laws of purity and impurity that affect her, which are very different? Look at the Mishnah, the way it continues. The Mishnah Nida Daf Lamed, Source 17. If she miscarried on the 41st day, she observes the laws of Tum of a male, and the birth of a female birth, and of a Nida. Rabbi Shmuel teaches, if she miscarried on the 41st day following conception, she has to observe the Tum of laws of both a male and a female. She doesn't know. If she miscarried on the 81st day, she observes the laws of Tumah of a male, of a female, and a Nida. For the basic form of a male embryo is completed the 41st day, and the basic form of a female is completed by the 81st day. This is based on our Parsha. Beginning of Tazria teaches 40 days, 80 days, and the Mishnah assumes there's a difference. The Chachamim disagree. Both the creation of the male and the female requires the same amount of time. This one and that one both require 40 days. Now, by the way, scientifically, it's very, very interesting. There are scientific journals which quote that while the fetus or the embryo, the cells have the capacity to emerge as either the XY, XX, the chromosomes. Chromosomally, the embryo could emerge either male or female. They begin to show the signs of identity at the 40th day. Science shows around the 40th day, and that's when essentially it's irreversible. That's why the Gemara in Brachos also says, by the way, it's appropriate to daven for the gender of your child till the 40th day. After that time, it's been determined, it's inappropriate. There's a Yerushalmi that says you could keep davening because it would be a hidden miracle, not a revealed one, because it would be... it's been known to change in utero. Right? My son, we were told early on in the pregnancy after a sonogram, was a little beautiful girl. We spent months thinking she was pregnant with a girl, and only later at another sonogram, it's an incredible story for another time. So, was it really a boy from the beginning, or did all the davening pay off? I don't know. It's not for me to say, but Baruch Hashem, he's a full and full all the way. You know, I volunteer to check his diaper regularly, and I'm telling you, he's a boy all the way through. Baruch Hashem, kenai nahara. So anyway, interesting, Source 18, Rabbi J. David Bleich in his bioethics book writes, in a footnote, it's perhaps of interest, again, based on this week's Parsha, it's perhaps of interest to note that Aristotle declares that male fetus endowed with the rational soul on the 40th day of gestation and the female on the 80th. Where do you think Aristotle got that from? Is it possible, the Mishnah? Is it possible, or the rabbis of the Mishnah, I should say? Is it possible from the Torah? This distinction corresponds not only to the respective periods of impurity prescribed by Leviticus, our Parsha, but to the opinion of Rabbi Shmuel in the Mishnah, who's of the opinion that prescribed periods of impurity correspond to the number of days required for the animation of the respective sexes, and therefore declares no impurity results from the miscarriage of a female embryo less than 80 days. Aristotle's representation of animation as occurring on the 40th or 80th day, depending on the sex of the fetus, was later incorporated into both canon and Justinian law. Very interesting. And as I said, it has halachic consequences. If a woman miscarries less than 40 days, what she miscarried will not create tumah. Does not have the status of a corpse. After 40 days, it does. Because 40 days is Maya Ba'alma. So, by the way, if you want to set up an account, this is the Shachan Source 20, Choshen Mishpat, if you want to set up a trust fund for a baby when a woman's pregnant less than 40 days, you can't. Only when she's pregnant more than 40 days. All of these halachic nafkaminas, 40 days is a serious demarcation. So, what's the status of an abortion before 40 days? Well, it's going to depend on what the reason is. If the reason is murder, so maybe before 40 days, you can't call it murder, it's Maya Ba'alma. Maybe Rav Moshe will be lenient before 40 days. Again, it's unusual to know you're pregnant or before 40 days, but let's say you know, maybe Rav Moshe will be lenient because you can't call it murder of embryonic fluid. But if the reason is Hashchasa Zera, if the reason is destroying seed, you can't destroy even seed that's embryonic fluid, mixed with embryonic fluid. So depending on your reason, before 40 days might be a leniency. And many posts can bring it as a variable, a snif lahatir. There are times where they will be lenient when the pregnancy, when the gestation is less than 40 days. What I want to do for the next 5 minutes, what I want to spend our time in to end the class, is to show you that, which is what the point of this class was, that while we live in a polarized society who have very opposite opinions when it comes to abortion, either pro-life, the living, it's tantamount to murder under no circumstances, or a very casual, flippant, it's the woman's choice, it's nothing, you know. Judaism have a much more nuanced view, which is that abortion is prohibited, it is forbidden. What's the nature? It's unclear, it's debated. Are there extended circumstances where it's permitted? Yes, when it comes in conflict with the mother. Is that because the fetus is alive? According to Rav Moshe, the fetus is a full-fledged life. It's murder, according, based on the Rambam. According to the Ramban, and therefore the Shevet Alevi, the Rav Osner, and others, no, the fetus is a potential life. And a potential life has some rights, but not enough to supersede the mother. According to others, it's not even a potential life. But maybe it's just seed, and that too is prohibited. But I want to show you a number of examples, the nuances in the poskim. As observant Jews, for us to say abortion is prohibited, blankly, uniformly, is simply inaccurate. Yes, the principle is abortion is prohibited, but there are many of nuanced circumstances. So here are just a few. Aborting a pregnancy of less than 40 days. This all comes from Nishmas Avram, page 9. A fetus which, according to the doctors, is 40 days old is halachically only about 26 days old. Right? Again, when you go to the doctor, a gynecologist, an OBGYN, measures the pregnancy from the first day of the previous period. But we know, halachically, that we measure pregnancy from the night of the mikvah. It couldn't have happened before that, which is at least 12 days after the first day of the last period. So when measuring the 40 days, the Nishmas Avram cautions, when measuring those 40 days of pregnancy, make sure you're defining it by the Jewish definition, not the OBGYN definition, which could be 12 days later than their definition. Right, he writes that extensively. The bottom of the left-hand column. Therefore, many Acharim tend to be more lenient with regard to the abortion of such a fetus, meaning before 40 days. Certain diseases, such as Tay-Sachs, can be diagnosed in the fetus before it is 40 days old by the technique of CVS, chorionic villus sampling. Procedure is carried out 10 to 12 weeks of gestation, carries a 2.3% risk of miscarriage of a normal fetus, additional risk of inducing congenital defects. In a study published in June 2002, CVS was carried out in 82 Orthodox women at 7 to 8 weeks of gestation, which is less than 40 days. The rate of miscarriage was 5% at less than 28 weeks. Rav Neubert, the author of Shmir Shabbos Kehilchos, who passed away a couple years ago, wrote to me that he'd spoken to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who told him in certain cases it would be permitted to carry out CVS, and if it were done before the 40 days had lapsed, it'd be permitted to abort an affected baby. So you see, Rav Shlomo Zalman, who may not have been lenient on Tay-Sachs later in pregnancy, was before 40 days because of this principle of Maya Ba'alma, that it's not a real bona fide pregnancy, it's not yet even a potential life. So therefore, if you could diagnose Tay-Sachs in under 40 days, there'd be greater room for leniency. When the pregnancy itself is a danger to the mother, page 10, situation where the danger to the mother is certain, even probable, there's no question the fetus must be aborted if there's no other way that her life can be saved. An abortion is then obligatory, and that's the ruling of the Shulchan Aruch. Meaning, not only is it okay, but it's obligatory. If the mother says, I'll die, let the fetus live, she's doing the wrong thing. It's obligatory to abort the fetus so that the mother lives. Now, Rav Zilberstein was asked. Rav Zilberstein is a son-in-law of Rav Yashev, a Rav in Bnei Brak. We're studying his Chashuk Echeme between Mincha Ma'ariv. The middle column, page 10. Rav Zilberstein was asked, a woman in the early stages of pregnancy was found to have cancer which obligated chemotherapy. Very interesting. Now, would it be permitted to abort the fetus since the pregnancy might endanger her during the therapy, even though the fetus itself was not a rodef? Think about it. The fetus here is not a rodef to the life of the mother. It's just that the cancer is the rodef, but being pregnant while having chemo lowers your ability for the chemo to be effective. So the baby is not directly a rodef. You see, there's such nuance in the questions. It's not at all simple. You can look at his answer. I don't want to go through it in depth. I'm just trying to show you that Judaism has such nuance to the question. The right-hand column. Where the danger to the mother stems from an illness that preceded the pregnancy. Let's say the mother chose to get pregnant, knowing she had an illness that the baby would challenge her. Is the baby still a rodef? She put herself in that circumstance. So the Yabia Omer of Avadya permits an abortion where there's a good possibility that continuation of the pregnancy will endanger the mother's life, particularly if the pregnancy is of less than 3 months duration. I'm sorry, a different case. The mother's pregnant, the baby's not yet a threat to the mother. It's early on in the pregnancy when it would be more lenient to do an abortion, but right now there's no problem. Everyone's healthy and well. But if the pregnancy continues, then the baby will threaten the mother. Can you abort the baby because of the potential, anticipating the threat the baby will pose, the fetus will pose? Rav Avadya said yes. Rav Moshe says no. It's forbidden to permit an abortion unless the opinion of doctors is the mother will almost certainly die if the fetus is not aborted. Unless you know the baby to be a rodef with certainty, you can't in anticipation that it likely will abort the fetus. You see, there's such nuance, there's such debate. Continuing the next page, 11. What about the next circumstance? A woman is diabetic and hypertensive. She's told by a number of doctors her pregnancy will endanger her life. She has to have an abortion. Fetus is endangering her life, and so on. She's admitted to the hospital with high blood pressure before 40 days have lapsed. Right? So she has these conditions. Maybe she didn't intend on becoming pregnant. She's admitted to the hospital. It's not yet 40 days. These conditions are going to worsen. Can she get an abortion? And there's a debate in this situation between the ER doctor, the internist, and her OBGYN. Rav Shlomo Zalman wrote to me that it would nevertheless appear the gynecologist is more experienced. Even the internist is such experienced as he, it would still be permitted to have the abortion immediately. Right? The internist was saying, nah, it's not a problem, we can control the blood pressure, the hypertension. The OBGYN said, if she continues with this pregnancy, she's going to die. Said Rav Shlomo Zalman, listen to the OBGYN. Let's say the baby doesn't threaten, the fetus doesn't threaten the mother's life, it threatens the mother's limb. Right? Number 9. A case, doctors warned her if she didn't have an abortion, she'd become totally deaf in both ears. So she'll live, but she'll be deaf. Can she have an abortion in order to preserve her hearing? It's another nuance. What about severe suffering during the pregnancy, but without danger? What if the mother, the pregnancy, the mother's going to throw up nonstop, be malnourished, be dehydrated, be in incredible, acute, unbearable pain? Is an abortion permitted to relieve pain, even if it never threatened her life? Even if it never threatened her life. Is pain tantamount to life? What about psychiatric illness? What if the mother has bipolar personality disorder? What if she has a psychiatric diagnosis that if she remains pregnant, she's going to have a psychotic episode, may become suicidal, may be unable to care for the baby? Is psychiatric illness enough to take the life of the baby? The Levushei Mordechai permits an abortion if, according to medical opinion, there's a danger the mother will become so severely psychiatrically ill it will entail danger to her life. Psychiatric illness is enough of a justification to abort as well, according to some opinions. What about, continuing, what about Tay-Sachs? What kind of diseases to the baby would permit abortion? Would Tay-Sachs be rubella, measles, Down syndrome? Page 13. Since Eliezer has a discussion. Knowing a baby will have Down syndrome, a parent feels incapable of caring for that baby. Would Down syndrome be enough of a justification for there? Even the Tzitz Eliezer is the most lenient with regard to an abortion. If the test is positive, right? He cannot give a general permissive ruling to apply in all cases. Rav Shlomo Zalman was strict in the case of Downs. What about a mamzer? A woman has an extramarital affair, and if you bring this baby into the world, the baby is going to be a mamzer. Mamzer is not allowed to marry a regular person. The Ben Ish Chai was asked about a married woman who became pregnant from another man, 5 months pregnant. Could she drink this medication which would abort the baby? It would be a chil Hashem, bring disgrace on the family, this child would suffer. Can you perform an abortion? And there are some lenient rulings. What about AIDS? What about rape? The woman is a victim of rape. Can she have an abortion? What about multiple pregnancy and fetal reduction? Often in cases of infertility today, when we do IVF, they don't just put in one embryo, they put in 4 or 5 or 6 in anticipation that they won't all take. Let's say they take. We've had cases in our community, halachic shilas like this. I remember one where a woman became pregnant with 6 fetuses. And the doctors determined it would be not only unhealthy to her life, but they would be competing with one another. It's possible none of them would make it. So you have to do what's called fetal reduction. You have to choose to reduce. So you're aborting some of them. Is it permissible? There's another nuance to that, which is, once you're reducing, can you determine which are boys and which are girls and say, you know what? I want boys, I want girls, I want exactly the same of each. I want the blue eyes, I want the 6-foot one, not the 4-foot one. You know, can you decide? But Rav Shlomo Zalman was lenient to abort some of the fetuses in order to save others. What you saw is that Judaism has a very nuanced approach. That unlike the normal conversation, which is really the polar opposites, there's a nuanced perspective. Abortion is prohibited. We value the life, the rights, or the potential life of the fetus, but there are circumstances where we permit it. I close with a great article by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Shlita, should have a continued Refuah Shlema. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein on the last page, page 15, puts the question of abortion in context and says, like all questions of halacha, we can't approach it from what makes us feel good, what makes sense, what the contemporary view is, but these are halachic questions. Look at the second paragraph. Judged by the standard prevalent today in most of the world, at least the Western world, the halachic approach presented here appears rather stringent. This requires no apologetics. It is worth making clear, certainly, that those who, in seeking a humane approach, are liable to adopt slavishly an overly liberal attitude, that from the perspective of the fetus and those concerned with its welfare, liberality in this direction comes at the expense of humanity, insofar as the caution of halacha is tied to its intimate concern for the value of kindness and mercy. It's not only the honor of God which obligates us, regardless of the cost, to avoid what is prohibited to obey the commandments of the Almighty that are expressed in halacha. It's also the honor of man in halacha, the humane and ethical element which insists on the preservation of human dignity, concern for human welfare, that rises up in indignation against the torrent of abortions. A very interesting conclusion, a very important one. Thank you, have a wonderful rest of the week and a great Shabbos.